This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Gordillo in this morning for Dave Ross. Colleen O'Brien here as well. And hey, Colleen, we're in the top five for the wrong reason this time.
Oh, no. What is it this time?
We are among the worst cities in the nation when it comes to porch piracy.
We have Sergeant Sean Whitcomb from the Seattle Police Department in with us to talk about how we can protect ourselves against porch pirates and how the Seattle Police Department is protecting us against porch pirates, too.
Yeah, porch pirates are the absolute worst. Everyone has this anticipation where they buy something online. You've got this thing that you're tracking, and there's all this care that goes into showing you that it's left this facility, and it's en route to an airport, and now it's on a truck, and it's loaded up.
There.
And you get home, yeah. And guess what? Your package isn't. It's like, well, what could have? I wonder if my neighbor picked it up.
No, nope.
Probably not.
Mm. Yeah.
Package thieves, they will go to these porches. They will grab the packages. They have no idea. Like, it could be
your next ship,
bird seed.
Yeah.
It could be soap. It could be a high-end camera. Like, you just don't know. So there's this element of gambling. And then hopefully they get something of value that they can turn around and resell. At the same time, it's no different than breaking into a car and stealing a duffel bag. Could be someone's stinky gym clothes, or it could, you know, hold a notebook computer and a bunch of cash.
So we're what, fifth in the nation for package theft? What are you guys doing, huh?
Well, the good news is that people are reporting it because that helps us with the data. Believe it or not, some people, they have their stuff stolen, they just reorder it. By reporting it to us, we know where it's happening and, more likely than not, who's doing it, because so many of these crimes are done by the same people. They're prolific offenders. Crime overall, especially property crime, is down this year. But at the same time, this is one of those areas where because we have such a dense city and so many people who work so hard and don't have time to shop, they order everything online.
Yeah.
It's just a target-rich environment. And so, like, we've heard the stories of, you know, people following the truck and snatching the packages.
I've seen
the
video surveillance. So many people have those cameras on their doorbells
now. Yeah, the Ring doorbell camera. Is that one of the big tools that you guys use to track them down?
Ring is absolutely great. So the thieves have fallen the delivery trucks. We followed them, too, with undercover detectives.
Oh, nice.
So it's this game of cat and mouse. But the whole point is, if you're expecting something that is valuable to you, don't take a chance with that. Everyone has the ability to have something delivered to a storage locker, or, you know, pick it up at the facility. I know it's inconvenient, but if you've ordered some high-end electronic, you want to make sure that's going to get into your hands.
Is it a unit that you put together around this time of year to follow and try to catch these porch pirates?
So I don't want to talk about this year specifically, but I can tell you that in the past, we have done focused efforts around this time of year with our undercover major crimes investigations detectives, specifically looking for prolific thieves and yes, going as far as following trucks to make sure no one else is following the truck.
It's like a protective unit.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Does this mean you have a database of potential porch pirates?
Not really a database so much as just the intelligence and diligence of our detectives who have focused on this work. As you mentioned with the Ring cameras, I mean, we get pictures of people who steal.
Right.
In some cases, it's just like, well, we don't know who that is. But in other cases, it's like, oh, really? That person again?
We just had an article in MyNorthWest.com about Seattle police arresting somebody believed to be a prolific porch pirate, a 34-year-old woman. How many things do you have to steal to be called prolific is my question.
So, I mean, the deal with prolific offenders is most thieves are actually pretty good at their craft. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to commit far more crimes than they usually get held accountable for. It's great if we can tie every burglary to a thief or every car break-in to a thief, but the fact is we can't, because there's usually not that forensic evidence that we would need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they did it. So when we do catch someone who steals a package, breaks into a car, or breaks into a house, or steals a car, there's a great deal of satisfaction because we know typically it's not the first offense, typically driven by chemical dependency. Mm-hmm. And it's sad, and there needs to be intervention. And we're working really hard with law enforcement assisted diversion. You know, there's a drug court, but ultimately, you know, the police mission here is to find out who's doing it, making sure they get identified. Typically that identification process also involves getting booked into jail and then making sure we've got a really good case for either the city attorney or the King County prosecutor to look at.
Do victims ever get their stuff back once you arrest a porch pirate?
Sometimes. Sometimes we actually, if we take down a big case, like we just had a case where we had taken down a theft ring that was operating in our downtown core. This was the prolific shoplifters who go into some of our downtown merchants, and we returned, it was well over $70,000 worth of property. Wow. And usually, here's the thing with property. Most people, it's like it's upsetting. Hopefully they can replace it, but it's those things that have the sentimental value, like people's jewelry. And that's what
And
really
I can't tell you how
us.
Many stories we've done where people's, the loved ones' ashes get stolen,
oh
too.
My
I mean,
gosh.
That's just
terrible.
Heartbreaking when that happens,
Absolutely.
Right? So I suppose, yeah, put it into perspective if this happens and you are saying, yes, Seattle Police, we're on it. We've got patrols out. We're not going to say exactly where or who or what they look like, but you're on it.
Yeah, and we're motivated. We want to make sure that these folks get held accountable because we know that for every crime that they get caught for, they've probably committed dozens.
Seattle Police Sergeant Sean Whitcomb, thanks so much for coming in today.
Always a pleasure, guys.
It's time now for Choke Points, brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. It's been several months since Sound Transit took down thousands of trees along I-5 to make way for the light rail extension up to Linwood. And boy, does it look different, Sully, as a longtime Snohomish County resident. I'm driving along the freeway going, this feels weird. It feels exposed, like somehow, you know, all of the freeway's clothes have been taken off.
Yeah, it's pretty well denuded.
Yeah.
Is a word you don't hear very often in traffic reporting or in reporting at all. And I mean, you're a regular I-5 driver, as am I, between Seattle and Linwood. And we've really been watching a landscape that's been changing.
Oh.
It seems like daily, you know, as they continue to excavate areas, clear to make room for the incoming tracks.
Yeah.
And the footprint for the station at 145th is also really starting to take shape there. That's probably the most overall visible change, how they kind of gutted that area and the construction zone there, besides all the naked hillsides.
Well in advance, though, of when light rail is actually going to get to Linwood.
Yeah, well, you got to remember, that's a pretty long extension. And they've got to get, this is all the work that needs to get done before they can actually start construction. So I sat down with Sound Transit's John Gallagher, and he said, besides that, most of the stuff that has been done, you really can't see.
We've done the clearing and the grading for the guideways. We've taken the trees out and demolition. There's a lot of work being done to relocate utilities that will be in the way of the guideway, need to be moved.
That most of that preliminary work has been completed, and now it's time to start construction. I visited the 145th station construction zone earlier this week, watching workers put together at least one of the metal forms that's going to be used to pour the concrete columns there that will eventually hold up the elevated portions of track.
It's going to be really noticeable over the next several months. It's already been pretty noticeable with the trees being cleared out and the grading being done so you can see where it's going, but you're actually going to start to see the construction happening soon.
Which means those columns are going to start going up and the public is going to get a really good sense of what's coming and what the line looks like. Now, if you can't quite picture exactly where the light rail line is going to go, I mean, you pretty much just follow the naked hillsides.
Well, yeah, and then it looks like it crisscrosses at the Mount Lake Terrace Park and Ride and then switches to the other side of the freeway.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it does.
So once is there going to be another overpass over I-5 in that area?
Yeah, they're going to put one right there between the one at 238th and the one just right there at Highway 104 that you take to go to Edmonds.
Yeah.
If you can't quite figure out exactly what it looks like, I put up an animation
at
mynorthbest.com so you could kind of look exactly
did
what it's going to
You
where
create
it's go.
This animation?
No, I did not. It came from Sound Transit, of course. Some of the tracks are going to be elevated. Some of the tracks are going to be at grade. So it's going to be kind of a mixed bag.
So it's going to be sort of alternating between the stations. And then just past Mount Lake Terrace, we cross over I-5 to the west side of the highway, run again elevated and at grade before we go into the Linwood Transit Center.
Now, this $2.9 billion project still on schedule. Linwood Extension should open in July of 2024. Northgate Station, by the way, should open in September of 2021. That's only about 18 months away or less. Gallagher says drivers need to be patient over the next 5 years.
Unfortunately, there will be some traffic impacts to that, which we'll try to, keep to a minimum. But, there will be, there may be some ramp closures coming up.
As you and I and Hannah have probably experienced over the last couple of days, there have been some overnight lane closures on the I-5 corridor there through Mount Lake Terrace. That's in relation to this.
Not to mention floodlights that are directly in the eyes of drivers as you go through there.
I mean, it's going to be a major construction zone. By the way, just to let you know, Linwood Extension is still running about $500 million over the original estimates. Sound Transit, of course, citing increased cost to buy the houses that they needed to use and increased construction costs, things like that.
Which the homeowner said, you're underbidding us anyway.
Yeah,
so let's give the other side of that
exactly.
as well.
Yeah, we know
like
a person
boo-hoo,
there who
you have
lost
to pay market value.
Yeah. who we know a person in this office who lost her home to this project. So that's where we are. So, but expect to start seeing a kind of a grove of concrete columns going up where those trees used to be as the line really starts going into construction mode now.
And the I-976, which is the CARTAB initiative, taking some of the money away from transit projects, is this at all going to affect this extension to Linwood?
Not according to Sound Transit, because Sound Transit's mantra from this is like, yeah, well, it doesn't impact us at all.
All right.
And that dovetails right into our 976 expert right here.
Hannah Scott in the studio now. Today was the day $30 car tabs was supposed to take effect.
It was. And, you know, as we know, last week, a King County judge granted the motion from Seattle and King County and the others who are suing to block this measure from taking effect. And he pushed pause while the legal battle was worked out on constitutionality questions. Then the state attorney general went and straight to the Supreme Court and said, asked the state Supreme Court to pause, essentially, and let the car tabs take effect today, because really the main argument here is, what's more damaging? The damage to the loss of dollars that the car tabs bring in for the various cities and transit agencies in the state, if we let this go and it's eventually found unconstitutional, or taking away the voters' vote who voted for 976.
I don't know if I buy that argument, though, because the governor has already said, hey, I've instructed them to already put these projects. So it's already affected just by the vote. Projects are being affected.
And that's just the state. It's the lower city transportation benefit districts that are going to lose money kind of quickly. But even then, in court, the state attorney general pointed out those folks like Seattle have reserves for their transportation benefit districts and could cover the cost while this plays out, because it's going to be expedited. Mm-hmm. For now, it's going to go back because the state Supreme Court rejected that, upheld the King County's judge's decision that put this is on hold. We'll go back now to King County while they'll play this out in that lower court pretty quickly, I expect.
And what's being argued that's so unconstitutional about this initiative?
It gets a little technical, but it's basically that it was the single subject and title rule, which is the ballot title, that it was misleading. That's really the main argument.
So the title made it sound like people were voting on something simple, when in the fine print, it was not so simple.
And just so I read today in the News Tribune, Bruce Dammeyer, it sounds like he's maybe trying to work with Pierce County to fight King County on their law, because 66% of the voters in Pierce County voted for $30 tabs, so they might try to get into the fight as an opponent to King County's suit to make it go forward.
And just to add some flavor to that, let's not forget he's a Sound Transit board member.
That is
too.
True. Yeah.
So this is
brother versus brother here fighting it out in the courts.
Meantime, we are shelling out hundreds and hundreds of dollars for the. Paid $410, and did that hurt for my car tab? So thank you for the update, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning, I'm Colleen O'Brien. Now, if you find yourself on a dating app, or maybe you have a child using dating apps, there's an alarming new report out about the way sexual predators are using these apps easily to find their targets. We have Keith Cousins. He is a fellow with Columbia Journalism Investigations, who was a part of this team investigating this trend. The report published in ProPublica and BuzzFeed as well, if you'd like to check it out in full. But happy to welcome Keith on Seattle's Morning News to discuss this. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us on.
This is so important. Not that it hasn't crossed somebody's mind, especially women, when they're using these dating sites. But what did you find about the prevalence of sexual predators using these apps?
Well, sure. And that's a great place to start. And when we started our investigation more than 16 months ago, we really found that there's not a lot of hard data as far as the scale and scope of this issue. So what our team at Columbia Journalism Investigations really worked hard at doing is to kind of create our own data. And kind of at the center of that effort was a database where we culled over 150 reports from media, from civil cases, from court and police documents, and really kind of looked at this issue as it's grown over the last 15 years. And we can't say confidently or statistically that the scale has increased, given that there's no kind of official studies from any agency or organization. But what we can say is that the large number of cases we found in our database are from the last 5 years, are from some of these really popular dating platforms owned by one company called Match Group.
You know, we had this conversation with Uber and background checks for drivers. Do these online dating sites make sure the information provided or the name of the person on this website using it is somebody who has not previously committed criminal acts?
There's not a lot of regulation in this area, both federally and at the state level. So we worked really, really hard to kind of measure the company Match Group. They're a Dallas-based corporation. They own 45 plus of the most kind of major online dating sites in the nation, OkCupid, Tinder, Plenty of Fish. We really measured them against their own public promises, as well as kind of the statements they're making in their terms of service. Right off the bat, in those terms of service, they state that any user is not supposed to be a registered sex offender. They're not supposed to be a felon. Different language depending on the platforms, but that is consistent throughout. Back in 2011, a woman named Carol Markin actually sued then Match.com. They've since rebranded to just Match because she was connected with who turned out to be a six-time convicted rapist and reported to police and the company that this individual had raped her. Carol sued Match.com not for monetary damages, but she really wanted to make sure that women using these platforms didn't experience what she experienced. So she sued them in an effort to get them to cross-check their users against state sex offender registries. And she was successful in that effort. And Match.com announced that they were going to start doing these checks against the sex offender registry. However, that was back in 2011, and Match Group, the parent company, has just grown and expanded so much since then. And what we've found through our investigation is that Match Group has not extended that same promise, that same safety protection to users of its free platforms like Tinder, like OkCupid, like Plenty of Fish. It has several niche smaller platforms like Our Time, which is geared towards the senior demographic. That's all paid for. You can't even get on the platform, really, unless you're a paid subscriber. And they do kind of offer those same screens with some of those smaller niche sites as well. But by and large, on these free platforms, there are no sex offender screenings.
How are these companies able to protect themselves legally, considering, I mean, you said you found about 150 cases where individuals said they were raped after meeting somebody on a dating site. How onerous is it to actually do a background check when I can even go on where I live here in Washington State and in my county and look up sex offenders who live near me and in my neighborhood? I can't imagine for these companies it's that difficult to have this safeguard so they can avoid these legal issues, not to mention protect their customers.
The rationale that's been provided to us by Match Group is that if they were to kind of expand these services, these sex offender screens across the board, that would do little but create a kind of false sense of security amongst users. And they feel that if they advertise, hey, we screen against sex offender registries, that individual users would feel that everyone on the sites is just clean, they have no criminal history, and then that they might ignore, say, things like the safety tips that are also included. We also found multiple examples of other dating platforms who have successfully implemented these screens, and even some that have gone above and beyond. I was able to spend some good time documenting and interviewing former employees of a platform called True.com. And True.com was founded by an entrepreneur from Texas named Herb Vest. And their whole thing was, it's right there in the name, they wanted people to be truly representing themselves on their platform. So before you could even get on and start communicating, start presenting yourself, you had to pass not only a sex offender register screen, but you had to also pass a check where they looked whether or not you were a felon. And then they also had this really crazy algorithm that they developed with a third party that kind of could determine or get pretty close to determining whether or not an individual was married. They didn't even want married people on their platform. And Herb told me, people can never rely 100% on these websites. They can never rely 100% on this industry. But he feels that if the industry as a whole would have kind of gotten on board with some of those efforts True.com were making, with some of the legislative efforts True.com was pushing, that he said the industry as a whole, we could have done so much better in this realm to really protect users.
Keith Cousins, he's a fellow with Columbia Journalism Investigations. We appreciate your time, Keith.
Thank you.
It's time for your Daily Dose of Kindness. A class of second graders from Linwood Elementary demonstrate what Giving Tuesday was all about. Giving Tuesday was just this week. Jeannie Warmouth's class did some fundraising, and on Giving Tuesday, they handed PAWS a check for $387 and $0.57.
They're very, very, very excited. It's the most money they've ever seen all in one place. So we actually counted it out penny by penny.
So they got a math lesson too, Mrs. Warmouth says.
It makes me very proud. It's what I am most proud of in my career.
And that's not all. Cairo 7 TV says Paws just received 15 dogs from a shelter in Texas. And Miss Warmouth's class wrote bios for each one of those dogs that are now posted online explaining why they should be adopted.
We came up with the idea of them writing adoption advertisements for the more difficult to place dogs and cats here at Paws. Most of my kids live within about a mile of the shelter.
The bios are a project her class does every year. And it was an extra bonus this year that the kids fundraised for the shelter. Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. You can hear Stacy Rost weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacy. Good morning, Stacy.
Good morning.
Before we get to the NFL, we have to talk about the XFL and the Seattle Dragons. They revealed their uniforms ahead of their first game in February. Initial thoughts on the uniforms, and please describe them to our listeners as well.
Okay, if you haven't seen them yet, the home jersey, I think it's the home jersey, is like a navy blue. So I feel like the blue color keeps echoing through. Yeah, dominant Seattle team. But they've got highlights of green and orange. So those are on the sleeves. And then, stripe down the side. The helmet has like a dragon and orange shoes. The helmet has a dragon on it. The helmet is where people are divided.
Why?
Some people don't like that there's an actual dragon on the helmet. Why? I tend to think it's pretty cool. I don't know, because they don't have an imagination, because they don't like nice things. I think it's fun.
What else are you supposed to do? I mean, most teams have their logo on the helmet.
Exactly.
Sully, where do you land on this? Do you like the dragon on the helmet?
I love the dragon on the helmet. I hate the colors.
Mm. You hate the colors? See,
yeah.
I love, but the thing is,
no green.
I like Miami's colors.
Well, see, that's the thing. So it's, I hate the University of Miami with a passion.
Oh, why?
Because,
but why, Sully?
Because when I was at Notre Dame, we had the Catholics versus convicts game. I was a student there at the time during those run-ins.
Catholics versus convicts?
So you're mad that they were so good?
No, we were mad that just because they were making fun of us so badly that we had to make it the Catholics versus convicts. You know, we won the national championship there. They won one. We won one during that time.
All right, so this goes back
but
for Sully.
But their uniforms
are so
cool.
You're not going to change
it. I hate orange.
Sully's not going to change on this.
Orange and blue don't match.
But it looks like the away jerseys.
Tell that to Denver, Sully.
I know. I hate their uniforms, too.
Predominant white for the away jerseys, again, with accents of green, blue, and orange. Okay. First game in February. Just quickly, remind us again what the major differences are between the XFL and NFL. What are we going to get with them?
I think with the XFL, it's not as campy as the kind of 2000 version of it used to be, but the rule changes, and I can't think of all of them now. They're minor things, are mostly intended to kind of make it a more fan experience. That's, think of if wrestling took over the XFL. Like, they want it to be more physical. They want it to be engaging. They don't want so many game stoppages. So, it's tough. I was looking at the AAF when that was first coming out. So there were rules like, you have to go for two instead of an extra point after a touchdown. So I can't remember if there's that for the XFL, but there are little things like that that are a bit different.
There's a lot in the kicking game, actually, as I was looking at that, it's almost getting to the point where they're almost completely eliminating the kickoff because you can't move on the kicking team until the person catches the kick. So they're going to get like a running start. So I'm not sure why that's better safety-wise, because now one team's going to be going full speed and the other team's going to be going none. I don't know. I saw something that they might let you choose between how many points you want for your extra point. And the further back you go, the more you could get, which I think that one's kind of cool. I hate the getting rid of the kickoff or changing the kickoff, but that's your
thing. But I think the whole point of the XFL, at least Vince McMahon's, the impression that left me was like, we aren't super pleased with the way that the league is becoming more and more like legislated, like where everything breaks a rule and, you know, it can't be tough anymore. And so we want to lean into that.
Well, maybe they can find out what a catch is and tell us what pass interference is.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Who knows?
Well, that'd
be exciting. Wonderful. We could get some clarification.
We'll be watching in February. Now, just quickly from the Seahawks Monday night game, have they recovered from their bouts with the flu and injuries?
It sounds like it. They actually left the game pretty injury-free. The biggest question mark is Ziggy Ansah. And Pete Carroll had a press conference yesterday. We didn't really get any answers there. So all you have to know about Ziggy Ansah is that he suffered a stinger in the game. That's what he was removed from the game for, and that it resolved. But what Pete Carroll said in his kind of morning after show with Danny and Gallant is that that shoulder injury that Ziggy Ansah had surgery for, that he'd been dealing with all offseason, is still an issue for him. So that was really kind of the takeaway, was the injury he suffered in the game wasn't the big question. It's how much his shoulder injury is impacting him moving forward.
All right. Stacey Rost, you can hear her again weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacey. She is our sports insider. Thanks, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
Hannah Scott sticking around because a big vote is coming up this morning on a plan for a regional homeless system for Seattle and King County. What's going on, Hannah?
So we've all heard about the regional approach that was necessary for years now. It was recommended that we streamline that approach in a homeless report from several years ago. And they made an actual proposal finally earlier this year. King County Executive Dale Constantine and Mayor Durkin did. Basically, it merges those two systems for the most part, the emergency homeless response, so shelters and things like that. In the months since then, Seattle and King County Councils both would independently have to approve this plan. There's been several meetings, and there's a lot of concerns, because the other idea is initially it would just be the city and counties merging, the county merging, but they want to attract the suburban cities and get them to eventually buy into it as well. So getting all of them on the same page, County Councilmember Jeannie Caldwell says, has been really tough.
What I've been trying to do is to get something through the King County Council that is, number one, workable, and number two, will go through. It's been a very tall order because this is a regional body. It is not a local city council. And there are very different views, and there are a lot of different challenges involved. So what we have before us now is something that I believe can get through.
And some of the issues that originally got the original plan bogged down is that it would create a 11-member governing board that was going to be essentially civilians, experts is what they were called, in homelessness. And that would be overseen by a steering committee that would have actual elected officials on it. But that governing board that would have almost all of the power on the policy making, no elected officials. So there was concern that there would be no politicians basically on that board. But some people think that's a good thing.
I was going to say there's concern there's no politicians involved, but it does sound, though, that they're sort of creating this 11-member celebratory public group, and then they have the overall power, though, this governing board, that the citizens will say, this is what we need, but the governing board has the actual power. So what's even the point? It's an advisory committee. It's not a...
What the governing board in the original proposal would have been is those civilians who got to make all the policy. The smaller steering committee with the elected officials on it had only the power to do an up and down vote on the budgets. That was it. All of the actual policy making came from that civilian board, essentially. That's now been reversed, though, in this policy from the changes. Jeannie Caldwell's worked over the Thanksgiving holiday to come up with a compromise with getting everybody in the room, trying to figure out how we could come to a middle ground and actually get something done. You know, there's a sense of urgency to get something done before the end of the year, because a lot of people on the Seattle City Council who've worked on this are not going to be here next year. Mm. So they kind of want to see it done. And then you've got new councils coming in. So maybe they don't like the plan and it becomes, you know, drawn out. So that's what's going on this morning.
So they're going to shove it down the new council member's throat.
It's tough to get anything done in councils in King County and Seattle. But when you're talking homelessness, it's really, really tough. Mm. And this is such a wide-ranging number of things. The other issue was that the suburban cities were concerned. They didn't have they had a seat at the table on one of the governing board in that original proposal, but only were going to get one or two seats. And they thought they were going to have a voice and would be forced to have Seattle policies with the tax dollars that they get from King County for their, you know, homeless responses. So now the revised proposal gives them four seats.
Like an electoral college system.
There's 12 total seats now, and it's four to the suburban cities, four to Seattle, four to King County, and four to another group.
All right.
This is going to be the Regional Policy Committee Agency, which is basically representatives from all of our local cities, Seattle and King County, voting on this morning at 9:30. It's not clear whether this is going to pass. I can tell you right now, even Jeannie Caldwell says she's not sure she's got the support there or on the King County Council. Listening to Seattle City Council this week, it's clear that they're not all on the same page either. So
all
we'll
right. I imagine you will monitor that vote, and we'll let you know what happens there. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.